meeting of the Creative Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee. And we have a quorum, you say? We have a quorum. So, Representative Miller, did you read the minutes?
I did.
Would you approve those minutes for me, please?
I would move for approval of the minutes.
Okay. Representative Miller approves the minutes of February 5th. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Now we'll start today. We're going to have a wonderful look at the Office of Broadband and Broadband Altogether, and we're looking forward to getting all kinds of educated. So we'll start out with Dana McKenzie, Executive Director of the Office of Broadband. And Matt, is he here? You can come now or later, whenever you want. We can pull another chair up. I think there's three chairs there. Welcome to our committee. Please give your name for the record and continue your wonderful presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Dana McKenzie, and I'm the Executive Director for the Office of Broadband Development. And I just want to thank you for inviting us here today to give you a little bit of an update, both on what the office has been up to for the last year since it was created, and then a little bit more information about the 2014 border-to-border broadband grant program. And you'll see the first slide on your presentation there is just a little bit on the highlights that we'll be touching on. And I don't know how, there we go. Thank you, Kim, I appreciate that. So first of all, what I wanted to do was just take a quick moment of your time for context setting, because I know you all don't eat, sleep, and breathe this like I do. So the first slide is just a little bit of a timeline to give you an idea of what has come before, the idea that policymakers have been engaged and working on this issue for a while. This represents the near-term timeline. Some of the highlights include in 2010 was when the state's statutory broadband goals were set, which is currently set at a minimum standard of 10 megabits down, 5 megabits up is the goal to reach all homes and businesses across the state with access to service of at least that level. And some of the other goals that were created around that time also involve being competitive with other states across the country and internationally on both access and adoption, but I won't get into those today. And then in 2013, legislation was passed to create the Office of Broadband Development, at which point we were able to open our doors within the Department of Employment and Economic Development in January of this past year. And then most recently, which is why you invited me here today, is that in May of 2014, the border-to-border broadband grant program was created, and we have been busy working on that, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. And so one of the pieces we were asked to talk about a little bit is what the office has been up to for the past year since its creation. It really falls into the three buckets that you see here on this slide, but I wanted to give you a quick glimpse of what's been keeping us busy. The first piece is just the establishing of the office and making folks aware that the state of Minnesota now has a specific point of presence for broadband-based issues. And so that activity alone has kept us busy meeting with dozens of stakeholder groups from both public and private groups, community groups, as well as individuals. All throughout the year, we've had dozens of meetings that have really talked about both educating them on what the state's goals are around broadband, what our strategies are, but also creating that two-way communications where we're learning where they see the gaps, because they're the ones on the ground really working to solve these issues. And what appears to be an unintentional consequence of creating this office is that the public now has a place to turn when they're looking for answers. And so we receive calls daily from both private citizens, as well as providers, as well as communities looking for help in connecting them with resources on both their personal as well as their community broadband needs. And so that has been a really positive, I think, unintended outcome of creating this focal point. We have also made sure that broadband is represented accurately and understood as part of measuring the state's overall social and economic health goals, and really working with MMB and the Minnesota Dashboard's reporting of the 40 key indicators indicating our progress towards really making this one of the best places to live. And we're glad to see that broadband is one of those points that's represented in that tool. And also, there was some questions about the mapping piece, and one of the pieces that we've done around this is work with Connect Minnesota and their parent company, Connected Nation. As many of you know, they've been working on the mapping for the state since 2010 under a federal grant program, and we've been working over the last few months to transition that to a more focused and right now interim solution that's focused on Minnesota's broadband goals specifically. I'm going to back up just a little bit. we've been busy this year. We've also, the second piece is really talking about building our relationships. And that sounds squishy, but it's probably the most important work that we do. And that not only includes across agencies and understanding that there's work that we can do shared amongst agencies, but it also involves relationship building with our federal partners that are working on this issue, including the USDA, the FCC, and NTIA, which are those agencies that work most closely with this issue in order to make sure that we are maximizing Minnesota's participation in these programs, and also discussing how we might coordinate and align our policies so that we can leverage each other's efforts in this arena. And finally, the big element that we've been working on is that grant program that we're here to talk about. That has been our top priority, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. So just briefly, the next slide you'll see is just a quick look at where we stand today. The bar chart there comes from Connect Minnesota and their work that they've been doing, again, over the last several years, measuring our progress towards this goal of border-to-border access. And you'll see here the chart shows that as of the last data collection, which was October of 2014, we were at 78% statewide had access to the minimum state speed goals of 10 down, 5 up in a wired environment, and slightly higher at 89% when we consider mobile. And you'll see that on the slides, you'll see that in red on your black and white copies. You'll see that as that second bar for those last three data gathering periods. And then while the slide doesn't show it, when looking at those numbers just for the greater Minnesota areas, those numbers drop, and we look at only 63% of those households and businesses have access at that moderate speed goal that the state has set. Some may note that the numbers we have on this slide, as well as some of our other materials, talk about these numbers in the context of 10.6 versus 10.5, which is our state goal. That has to do with the data gathering process that was defined by the federal government, which wasn't specifically aligned as the state's goal. Going forward, we'll be working directly with those gathering the data, so they'll be aligned with Minnesota's policy specifically.
Representative Mahoney has a question.
And I'm just going to ask you to repeat. You said 63% of the number drops to 63% for Greater Minnesota for connectivity. Could you just repeat that sentence? So I'm writing stuff down.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, committee members. That is correct. 63% of households and businesses in Minnesota, as of this
Greater Minnesota,
of Greater Minnesota, have access to the 10 megs down, 5 megs up, which is currently the state's goal and minimum speed standard.
Now, if I have Frontier Phone Company and they quite don't have 10 down, 5 up, or whatever it was, is that, that doesn't count then? They're a little short.
Mr. Chair. Absolutely, that is correct. And in fact, you'll see in a moment here that Frontier is actually participating in one of our grant programs to allow them to enhance their services to get to that higher speed standard.
Very well. So that they are not counted as giving us high speed because they're a little short, right?
That is
gotta
correct.
Be at least
5 up, 10 down, or whatever it was.
Thank you.
And I'm not going to spend too much time on this next slide that you've got, but it was just a reminder that the state does have additional goals in statute around being competitive nationally and internationally in regards to both access and adoption and use, and we can talk about that at some point in the future when we broaden our discussion to other aspects of this issue. The next slide you'll see is a map that we had created to help communicate spatially where the state is at as far as the areas that qualify for the grant as written. And we have a couple of large format maps that are in color that are going around that help you help communicate this issue a little bit better. I chose this one because it shows it highlights the areas in the state that don't have access to the minimum standard that was the federal standard when the grant language was written, which is the 4 down, 1 up. It doesn't focus as much on the 10-5, although that's represented here as well. So those red areas on that map that you see are those areas where there is population, where there are people living in our state and that do not meet the federal standard at that time. I also asked the map maker to drop out the census blocks where there is no one living so that we don't overstate the problem. So when you see the white areas on the map, that's what that is expressing, is there aren't any households in those areas. And then you'll see the lavender or the darker blue represents those areas that meet that FCC standard at the time but don't meet the state standard. And as you can see, this map tells us that there are still pockets all across the state that don't meet that goal that has been set. And just very briefly, this slide gives you the high-level points on the grant program as it exists today. It was a $20 million one-time appropriation distributed through a single competitive grant round. The technology that was required in all proposals was that it was scalable to 10 to 100 megabits bidirectionally. The grants were capped at $5 million, at least a one-to-one match. There was additional weight given for applications that brought more match to the table, geographic dispersion of awards, and that eligible applications locations were either unserved or underserved by the definitions that were worked out in the legislation last year. Just wanted to kind of bring people back to the specifics of the grant program. The next one is just, again, to give you some idea of the process and timeline that we followed. The program was funded in May of last year, and we spent the next 8 months building the program, accepting applications, doing evaluations, doing due diligence. And what's a little bit unique about this program that that I don't think there are others like it in Minnesota is that we are potentially granting into a competitive environment. So there was a challenge process. There was a challenge window where we published all of the grant applications and the areas they proposed to serve, and we worked with providers to have the ability to submit a challenge to the claim that an area was either considered unserved or underserved. We did receive 33 challenges all told, but they were all relatively straightforward in resolving in working with both the challenger and the applicant.
Representative Mahoney has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned how many applications or grant applications you got. I don't remember. 40.
That's actually our next slide.
How are you handling, if you handed out 15 or 20 and you had 40 applications, that leaves you another 20 or 25, do those just roll over to the next year, or does the grant applicant have to reapply? Or is that the next slide?
I will get into the number of grant applications we received in the next slide. As far as rolling over, this, as it currently stands, this was a one-time program, so there technically isn't anything for us to roll it over into yet until you all finish your discussions this session, and we'll see. So at this point, and likely we have learned some lessons about the administration of this grant, so there will likely be some minor tweaks to the application process based on the lessons learned as well. So it would be a new process.
Continue.
Great. So then moving on to that next slide, and you'll see that we did receive 40 applications. We were happy to see that they represented all areas of the state, except with the southeast area. We didn't receive anything in the extreme southeast area of the state. Great diversity in types of applicants. Phone companies, broadband providers, specifically cable companies, municipalities, both fixed and wired service providers, as well as some newly created entities. So we were happy to see that broad diversity as was allowed for in the legislation. The total that was requested was $44.2 million in grant requests, with a total project value of just under $100 million. And so we, for a first-time program where there was a lot of uncertainty about whether or not we were serious and how this fit, we were very happy with that response. The next slide is dense, and I'm not going to go through it, but it's here for a couple of specific reasons. First, to demonstrate how we believe we followed the legislative intent with the evaluation process. This is our evaluation criteria that was included in the application, so all applicants had this information when submitting the application. And second, we know that some of you are receiving contacts from your constituents about that may not have been funded or had questions about the program. So this information is included here so you have it at the ready. And then after a thorough evaluation, we identified 17 high-quality projects that we were able to fund with the $19.4 million that we had to distribute. Which leveraged a $25.8 million match, which equates to about a 57% match, with a total project investment of both public and private at just over $45 million. And for that investment, we reached just under 6,100 passings, which is both households and businesses, and you'll see there the breakout of on an underserved. And I won't spend much time on this next slide, but again, it's just so that you have it easily available. This is a list of all the awardees and the amounts that they were awarded. And we are happy to see, and I'll get to that in a moment, that we were able to achieve good geographic diversity in those awards. The size of projects on this list range from 21 passings all the way to the largest of 1,350 households and businesses will be served by the largest. And again, the full $19.4 million is represented here in this list. The next slide is just again to reinforce that we were able to achieve the legislative intent of geographic dispersion. We reached all economic districts in the state, and I think we have got good projects happening in all areas of the state. And then very briefly, I was asked to just comment on looking forward, and I can say that, and which we're all aware of, the governor is recommending a $30 million fund for the fiscal year 2016 in his biennial budget recommendation, and that would be under the same definitions as the current program, with no recommendations for policy language changes at this time. And just for context setting, again, our research shows that Minnesota is one of 14 states that is providing infrastructure development in some form, so we certainly have peers in this work. We feel the language was a good base to start from. The current language gave us ample room to make funding decisions that were consistent with the legislative intent as expressed during last year's session. Our intent this year is to really focus on the implementation of the current round of awards and do a thorough analysis of whether we're meeting the goals that the state set out to achieve, and to bring this data back to help inform the discussion of any future changes that may be warranted. While it's acknowledged that the decisions being made at the federal level will ultimately have an impact on what happens here in Minnesota, including the Connect America Fund determinations and the new federal broadband minimum standard of 25 megs down, 3 megs up, we believe we can continue to make forward progress in Minnesota using the legislative definition as they stand today. And again, our office has anecdotal evidence by the phone calls that we are receiving that we anticipate a larger response to this program should it continue going forward. We're hearing both from communities that didn't feel they were organized enough to get a competitive application in last time, as well as providers who are expressing they didn't step up last time but have a better understanding of how they could participate in a program like this. And again, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to give you a brief update, and happy to take any questions.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, thank you very much for a great presentation. And could you, in the original legislation, there was a 3% set aside for administrative, up to 3%, I don't think it was a mandate, for administrative costs and other activities. And I wondered if you could outline for us how that was used, if you used the full 3%, and if you did, was it on the mapping? Was it on administrative at the department? How did that money get used?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the question. Absolutely. And those funds have been retained at this point as a brand new program. We're not able to draw on historical information on what it's going to take to administer this. So we reserve the full 3%, just knowing if it's a one-time program, we want to make sure we account for a full 3 years of oversight of the awards that have been made, in addition to the mapping that was also included in the legislation. And those are the two big chunks of where we anticipate those funds will probably be utilized.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You received grant requests of almost $45 million, and yet the governor only put $30 million into it. Would you be opposed if the chair chose to decide to bump that up so you could actually fulfill all those? And you know, I've been tracking the bills that have come in, and there's a lot of money being proposed. I think it's a good idea. The other question I The other question I have is, if with whatever the allotment is your intent to do it all as soon as you can get it out, or do half 1 year and half the other?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for those questions.
You take the $45 million. I know that answer.
The governor's recommendation is really based upon obviously managing multiple priorities and the idea that of taking some measured steps forward. And so it is my job to execute what you all complete, and so we will be stand at the ready for whatever happens in that regard. And remind me what the second half of your question was.
Mr. Chair and Ms. McKenzie,
the distribution.
You know, yeah, the distribution. Are you going to do it all up front or in the first year, or are you going to try and split it so you do two rounds of grant awards?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for that clarification. We, at this stage, we will likely, given what we are seeing happen in preparation, the applicants are going to be more prepared this round. We are going to run a process that will be prepared to distribute the full amount in the first year of the biennium. However, that said, we will reserve we'll reserve the possibility that it may be wiser, depending on the readiness, to bring that over a two-cycle process. One of the things is we need to make sure that we allow the applicants the ability to have two full construction seasons to execute on these grants, because some of them are large enough that do require those two construction seasons, so we have to be cognizant of that requirement when we make those decisions.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just kind of throw my three. There's three questions, but they all kind of fit together, so I'll throw them on the table and respond. So I did the simple math, and the state investment for the touches that you had is about $3,300 per, I'm going to call it household, but per touch, however you determine that to be. Is this just not profitable for private industry to expand in our state so that they don't, I mean, is it just not equitable? So therefore, the grant money is needed to invest in this, and maybe I understand the model. And with this investment, do you have a projection of how much longer the state's going to be investing this and how much the total dollar amount is? So if it's $20 million this year, another $40 million, is it going to take another $40 million to achieve these goals? And what reporting do they need to provide to prove that there's a return on this investment?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. I may need to ask you to repeat parts of that question.
The chair only allows me one question, so I just bulked them all together.
All right.
I'm just kidding, Mr. Chair.
I think he's treating the freshman right.
As far as the model is concerned, it is widely recognized that the reason it hasn't reached to the areas where the state is getting involved is that the current classic private business model for serving those areas doesn't work in areas with low density. So that's really where the state has chosen to get involved from a policy standpoint. As far as what the overall costs of closing the gap, of achieving our goal of border to border, I'm going to defer some of that to Mr. Gross, who's going to speak after me, because the task force has spent some time discussing that issue. And as far as reporting, well, it's fairly simple right now. The state has set a goal for achieving access to every home and business. So we will continue to measure that and tell the story, and obviously hold our awardees accountable for meeting that measure. That measure is pretty black and white. We are working with DEED in addition to that, to some of the other performance metrics that you're used to seeing from other DEED programs. We're working on developing that, but for this program, they don't yet exist.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the testimony today. My apologies for being late. As always, we all got 15,000 things going on, but I do appreciate that. Your testimony today. A couple of questions. First of all, in your documents, you use the term passings. I apologize if I missed that, but can you just describe what a passing is in terms of the metrics?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the clarifications. It's difficult to choose a word that's meaningful to everyone. Passings is meant to be inclusive of both homes and businesses. And while the legislation, I believe, specifically talks about households, now that we're housed within Department of Employment and Economic Development, we're very tuned into the business side of the house and that language and making sure they're included.
And Mr. Chairman, the testifier, so in a passing, does this actually take it to the house or does it take it to the sidewalk with then local providers would need to provide that last link to the home?
Thank you. It all depends upon the proposal. The technology that's proposed in these the legislation did not dictate a specific technology. Each proposal has a slightly different configuration. While most of them talk about bringing service completely all the way to the home, there are a number of the proposals, including some of the funded proposals, that push fiber deeper into the neighborhood but don't take it all the way to the home.
And Mr. Chairman, to the testifiers, I should give it my background in my private sector job is as a network engineer, but I also have this new role in the legislature where I have to be really careful when I offer my opinions on anything. So those are coming in conflict right now in this moment. No disrespect intended if I ask some more difficult questions, but they're more on the engineering side. Were wireless or satellite services considered as part of this this grant making process?
Ms. McKenzie.
Mr. Chair. Committee members. The language of the grant was agnostic. However, it did agnostic to technology. However, it did specifically indicate wireline service. So there was a significant focus on wireline service. That said, we looked at the technical requirements. Is the technology able to scale to 100 megabits both bidirectionally? And satellite service to this stage does not do that. What we found in a majority of the applications is it's still challenging for the fixed wireless technology to also meet those standards, although we were very, very close to that, and I would expect we'll have more discussion around that in this, if should there be a future round.
And Mr. Chairman, so it's important that members of the committee understand that if there's any mistake or unintended public policy consequences where we are incentivizing infrastructure that is not future-proof, that may become obsolete in the future, it is not the Office of Broadband Development that made that mistake. The legislature passed a law saying it has to be wired. And with regards to the technology that's out there, there's a lot of fascinating things that are happening in wireless and satellite. If you just look at the costs of infrastructure, Representative Miller brought this up earlier, just the grant portion of this to get to a single passing is $3,000 a household, or $3,000 a passing, which doesn't even mean that everybody on the service is signing up for it. So we're paying $3,000 to have the infrastructure there, so maybe some people could sign up, but in reality, probably within 5 years, we're going to see wireless or satellite services that are on par or maybe even superior to the wired infrastructure. And this is why politicians are not engineers. This is why legislators don't make engineering decisions. It's not the fault of the Office of Broadband Development. They're doing what the legislature told them. But just from a pure technical standpoint, there's a reason why the engineers are not making these investments. And the reason why is because this is not mature technology. Brownies are not fully baked. The analogies to wastewater infrastructure and water pipes are false. Water pipe technology has essentially been the same for 60 to 70 years. The way that we are delivering content via streaming, via fiber, via wireless is in no way mature. And in fact, the evolution of where the marketplace is going is the exact opposite of what public policymakers are requiring investments in right now. So I just want those things. Those are the facts. They're not in dispute. I do not hold the Office of Broadband Development accountable for that because they're doing what the politicians told them to do, but it's something that I think legislators may want to take a second look at. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any comments for that? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple of questions also. I'll hit you with two first, and the other one you may want to answer later. We talked about administrative costs. What are the administrative costs, and how much staff do you use for your portion of this?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the question. As alluded to in the previous question about this, we are still unclear about what the administrative costs are going to look like for this grant overall, and so that's why we're being cautious and reserving the full 3%. Any unused funding will certainly roll back into the distribution pool. But the two primary things I believe I mentioned were the mapping component and the administrative costs. And right now, the administrative costs consist of one grant administrator and a portion of an administrative support person that also provides support for the remainder of the office's operational endeavor.
So two?
One point two five.
Okay. The other question then, you were asked about the overall cost, but I haven't also got, and in with that, you're looking at really only a few thousand people that you've got access to for the amount of money that you're spending so far, and how many years are you going to be looking at to complete this? Well, basically what I'm asking, are you going to be a permanent entity trying to get broadband to every house, or is there an estimated goal of when you're going to finish this?
Ms. McKenzie.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the question. At this stage of the game, we are operating under the direction of the legislation that created the office, which was until the state's goals of border-to-border access have been achieved. At this stage, we are monitoring the progress, and some of our peers in industry peers will talk in a little bit about the progress that's been made without public involvement. But there is some recognition we are getting into the area where we are involved is the area that is not necessarily going to happen at the pace that we would like to see it happen without some additional gap financing. So. To answer your question, there is not a specific end date to our office. At this stage, there is work being done at the federal level, there's private investments, and there's state investments, and we will continue to monitor that progress and come back to you on an annual basis or whenever invited so that you can refine those goals and directives as you see fit.
Just one more thing to Representative Miller. The answer to your question, why aren't private businesses doing it, is you are correct in that there is not sufficient money for them to do it. The cost for a private person to put it in is far too great, and the local companies would never get a return on their money, and that's why we're doing it through the state level.
Representative Norton.
Well, I just... since the department and others didn't want to jump in on this, I will just respond briefly to my esteemed colleague next door. I think many, my colleague next door. With regard to the build out of broadband, you know, I don't think any of us would deny that technologies are changing, whether it be, you know, the phones that used to have the dial till cellular, that we build things that become obsolete. That happens in industry, it happens in business. But I will say, even right now, as we're trying to help these individuals and businesses have the technology that it will take to be economically viable and grow, we do need to help them, and we are helping them. And in fact, there are some businesses in my own community, and I learned this actually attending the meeting of the governor's task force, who require landline, who will not allow satellite technology to be used because of their business security issues. And so I actually have colleagues in town who are required by their employer to have landline. Yes, it will change, and I don't argue at all with my colleague that will change, but I think we need to build for today, knowing that things will change. It is expensive, yes, it's hard to do this, but the market was not taking care of it. So I just want to clarify, there are some businesses who are requiring landlines right now and will not support a satellite being used if they're working from home, and we have a lot of people working from home down my way.
Manley, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question regarding kind of the coverage area. It hits on a few of the questions asked earlier by, I think, Representative Garofalo and others. And it's based on a conversation I had with a constituent who lives about a mile out of town and runs a business, and you know, I didn't know where he lives, so I looked him up, and he's kind of in the middle of a road in which not too many people live on that road. So I'm just trying to understand what his expectation is, or what the office's expectation is for providing coverage to that type of remote, maybe, or not a city dwelling. So that's kind of a question. Just let that hang for a minute. But then some of the projects here are like Big Stone County, $3.9 million, Rock County, $5 million. Is the implementation for those counties like throughout the whole county, so that there's no bad coverage, to use a cell phone term, throughout the whole county? Is that kind of the expectation going forward, that no matter where you live, you would have broadband coverage in the future?
Ms. McKenzie.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the clarifying question. And really, it goes back to, we are executing on the state statute that says we have a goal to achieve access to a moderate level for every home and business in the state. And so that is the guiding principle behind the decisions that we're making, along with the specific language of the border-to-border grant as it exists today. So regardless of what our feelings are, that is what we are executing on. And to your question about the projects on the list that appear to be countywide, in both of the cases where I think you mentioned, that's what they are striving for. The Big Stone County has a private provider that has been able to serve about half of the county. And in fact, Big Stone is partnering with a private provider for this grant program, and that private provider will be striving to reach the remainder of that county. I've not done an analysis if that puts them at 100% coverage at this stage of the game. And Rock County's project that's on this list, again, they've partnered with the private provider, and their goal is very explicitly to serve everyone in their county.
And
then just a quick qualifying another question related to that. Again, I'm trying to get up to speed on how broadband gets immersed into the community, both in the city and the county. How different is a good analogy, using kind of an analogy of a cell phone coverage, that's satellite-based, but yet there are still pockets of dead space within a county, within a rural area. This is all, back to Representative Garofalo's point, landline. So you would think there would be a higher concentration of dead spots because you have to lay the fiber. Is there any comparison between the two as far as coverage area and what the expectation would be 5-10 years from now? Would it be similar to cell phone now, in which you have a lot of dead spots, although less so in the past? Do you know what I'm trying to ask?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. I'll take a stab at it. I think our representative from AT&T might help shed some light on this during his comments. But we look at the two as separate goals at this stage of the game. It's also critically important that we have border-to-border coverage to the best extent possible for mobile broadband, for public safety, for all of the reasons we all know when we reach for our phone, which is a separate and unique set of benefits. And we've got some excellent private investment that's happening in that space everywhere in the state as we do the wired piece. As close as I can come to your question about comparing coverage expectations is more along the lines of what are our coverage expectations of wired telephone service and electricity, and which is in the 98% range, somewhere in there, and that's how we think about it.
Very good, thank you.
And Mr. Gross, you have a presentation you'd like to give us?
Sure.
We have four more testifiers afterwards.
I'll make it quick.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Matt Gross. I'm the superintendent for Deer River Schools, which is in north central Minnesota, situated in between the Iron Range and Leech Lake Indian Reservation. Serve about 1,000 kids, covering 540 square miles. So we're in greater Minnesota for sure. Appreciate your work in this regard. I bring greetings and regrets from the chair of the task force, Margaret Anderson Kellier. She's in Washington, D.C., in her capacity as president and CEO of the Minnesota High Tech Association, so I'm filling in for her. And my role today is to talk about the task force, as well as the recommendations that the task force are charged with producing as far as in terms of their legislation that created the task force. The Task Force on Broadband was created to develop, implement, and promote state broadband policy, planning, and initiatives to achieve state broadband needs and speed goals, and is responsible for developing an action plan to identify and correct disparities in access and adoption of broadband in all Minnesota communities, with the goal of ensuring that homes, schools, hospitals, and businesses have access to the technology and information resources they need. I believe a copy of the annual report for 2014 was included. I have other hard copies here available if you need one. As a reminder, and as Dana mentioned, the state goal is greater than 9 megabits per second download and greater than 5 upload. And as of October 2014, as she mentioned, nearly 37% of rural Minnesota households are unserved by fixed service at those speed goals. And in regards to the question about cost, the Broadband Task Force investigation into that estimates the total cost of providing broader border-to-border broadband access in the neighborhoods of $900 million to $3.2 billion. Obviously great variability, and I think some of our providers could talk about the variability in construction costs and equipment costs needed to do that, but that's the neighborhood that we've investigated. Investing in broadband development is crucial for enhancing Minnesota's status as a leading technology state and for ensuring that our residents and visitors have access to commerce and public institutions. support and investment from the state plays a significant role in achieving those speed goals. In the last year, the task force spent a number of meetings and numerous hours studying issues related to this year's recommendations. And in the report on page 8, those recommendations are detailed, and I'll review those quickly. These are not ordinal or particularly ranked, but number one, the Office of Broadband Development Funding. The task force recommends appropriating $2.9 million to the Office of Broadband Development for the next biennium, which includes $1.5 million for operational support and program delivery, as well as $1.4 million for continuing data collection and mapping statewide broadband availability. Second, continuing the infrastructure grant program, the task force is recommending appropriating $200 million to the border-to-border broadband development program. And while that's a large number, it's a significant fraction of the $900 to $3.2 billion that I mentioned earlier that's estimated to be required to meet the border-to-border goals set by the state. Three, create an Office of Broadband Operating Fund to promote broadband adoption and use. That fund would be managed by the Office of Broadband Development at an amount to be determined between the Office of Broadband Development and the legislature. That would allow the office to support and advance and develop programs aimed at ensuring adoption, getting at Representative Garofalo's comment about whether those connections are actually physically made to the business or to the house. Number four, increase telecommunications aid for schools and libraries. The task force is recommending funding library telecommunications aid at $6.6 million over the biennium and increasing telecommunications equity aid for schools to $9.7 million over the biennium. That funding would expand the impact of that program or those programs in underserved areas and ensure children have access to reliable broadband service that keeps up with the increasing demand in terms of bandwidth. Next, expand video healthcare and telemedicine initiatives for third-party payer reimbursement. Video healthcare and telemedicine are becoming more essential to increasing access and the quality of care available to the residents of rural Minnesota. With the number of physicians and pharmacists in decline in rural Minnesota, extending the reach of providers located in urban areas to greater Minnesota is already nearing an essential stage. Given rural Minnesota's aging population and the concentration of providers in large cities, the use of broadband to provide additional interaction will be a growing need in order to ensure service equity. Six, support efforts of schools utilizing one-to-one devices. The task force recommends that the Minnesota Department of Education research existing programs in Minnesota and across the country to determine best practices for implementing one-to-one device programs in our schools. The result of that research would be best practices and guidelines developed by the department for use by Minnesota schools to ensure maximum effectiveness of those efforts. Seven, make sales tax exemption for telecom permanent. The task force recommends the existing sales tax exemption for telecommunications equipment be made permanent to provide certainty to providers and enable thoughtful, future-oriented investment planning. Further, the task force believes policymakers should examine the possibility of expanding the exemption to include additional equipment like fiber that would assist in network development efforts. Finally, to review existing permitting criteria to see where there might be opportunities for efficiencies, including a review of existing permitting requirements impacting broadband network deployment to determine where there may be opportunities to ensure the most efficient processes are in place. We know that uncertainty over permitting timelines and requirements can delay or even prevent network deployments from moving forward. As you can see in the report that was sent to you and the maps that are in the report, there's additional detail and identification of areas of the state, largely rural areas, that have inadequate access to broadband. And these recommendations by the task force are meant to address that inequity in access. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we have some testifiers. Paul Wertz. Oh, Lisa McCabe, excuse me. Lisa McCabe is first. Senior Director of the Public Policy Satellite Broadcasting and Communications Association. Welcome to our committee. We have about 12 minutes if we break it all equal. So if you can make it fit in that time frame, we'd appreciate it. Give your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Lisa McCabe, and I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Satellite Broadcasting Communications Association. We're the trade association for the consumer satellite industry, which includes satellite broadband providers HughesNet and Viasat, who compete to offer satellite broadband throughout the country. Currently, there are about 1.6 million satellite broadband customers across the United States. There are about 25,500 in Minnesota, and both they go under the brand names Exceed or HughesNet service. And our marketplace is primarily ex-urban, very far suburbs where you have very low DSL, slow DSL service, and also in the remote and rural areas. So we're targeting areas where there aren't where there are no other options for consumers to have internet service. And the service was initially launched in about 2008, and since then, in 2012, both HughesNet and Viasat launched new satellites that increase their speeds and coverage across the country. And there's a map in your handout. Currently today, on average, customers get about 15 megabits download to 5 up. In Minnesota, you can see there's a on page 3 of the handout, there's a map that's green and yellow. And you can see that currently the majority of the state of Minnesota is in this 5 to 15, about 12 megabits download speed, 3 up. And there is the northwestern portion of the state that's still in 5 to 1 megabits download speed. But both companies do have plans to launch higher speed satellites in 2016, which we hope to have speeds of upwards to 10 to 20 megabits across the country. And as far as price goes, the average price is about starts at $50 a month for customers. So satellite broadband, we're here today basically to tell you that there is there's another option out there for consumers, that satellite broadband may work for a number of people, and that we have the satellites that pass over low density areas that are there to provide a service. And these are two companies that are hoping to make inroads into that service. Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Another thing we have to look at as part of the mix in the future.
Next, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, pardon me.
Would it be wrong for me to say "See, I told you so," or is that,
well,
that too soon?
You get to say that several times. next, we have Paul Wirtz and Andy Sackrider. Help me out.
Sackrider.
This is the way it sounds spelled.
This is the way it's spelled.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. My colleague is Mr. Andy Sackrider. He's the director of engineering for AT&T Minnesota Northern Plains. We're very pleased to be here today and appreciate, Mr. Chairman, the opportunity to speak to the committee on a very important issue concerning broadband. We really have two focuses here. Really, one is to educate the committee on the investments that AT&T has made in the state of Minnesota concerning our wireless coverage in the state since 2010. And the other one is really a forward-looking possibility that we're hopeful, should we secure the approval of FCC with our acquisition of DirecTV, we will be offering a rural broadband service to Minnesota, actually part of a nationwide service that we've committed to. So I'd like to go a little bit detail about that as well. As a company, AT&T is committed to building out our wireless broadband infrastructure. We certainly know the demand for wireless broadband is exploding. It's a wildly successful and popular technology, and it's getting faster and faster. It's becoming a necessity in all areas of life, from education to healthcare, business, and economic development. And when we talk about delivering broadband to all corners of the state, we're certainly, you know, we hear a lot about wired broadband, but wireless broadband is a crucial piece of the picture, and it is a way that we're going to deliver speed to many areas that might not otherwise have that. Now, when we talk about wireless investment, we're talking about 4G LTE, long-term evolution coverage. It's the latest broadband technology that has mobile speeds that are 10 times faster than the old generation of 3G, with download speeds up to 12 megabits per second, even exceeding the state broadband standards. That means you're able to do many of the things that on your smartphone or your tablets, or in my case with an iPhone 6, a phablet, because it's becoming a phone and a tablet together, that you might be able to do on a wired computer connection. As a result, we're seeing more demands for high-speed internet, mobile capability across the state. In here in Minnesota, and I believe in your packet, this first map, this is kind of where we were in 2010. AT&T was undergoing a national project called Project Velocity, Project VIP, and it was our corporate focus to deliver 4G LTE coverage to more than 300 million people nationwide by the end of 2014. That's where we stood at the beginning of 2010. That represents, there were 3G, some 2G, some of the basic elements of broadband that you could do at that point. Fast forward to today, where we have nearly the entire state covered with 4G LTE capability and speed and coverage. This represents more than $500 million of investment that we've made since 2010 in the state of Minnesota. As I mentioned earlier, our commitment was to provide this service to more than 300 million people by the end of 2014. We actually reached that benchmark by Labor Day of 2014, so we're very proud that we were able to exceed that goal of getting that out faster. But with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Andy Sackrider. I'm the RAN Director of Engineering for AT&T, and RAN is Radio Access Network. My team does all the planning, the design, and the optimization of the wireless network for AT&T in Minnesota. We also have North and South Dakota, Iowa, Nebraska, and Western Wisconsin. As Paul mentioned a couple minutes ago, we spent over $500 million between 2010 and 2013. That work represents hundreds of AT&T engineers, contractors, technicians, and that's the primary reason why the map went from what you see on page 3 in your packet to page 4, or the map that is up here. A few of the things that we've done, we've built over 30 sites, upgraded a lot of our sites with Ethernet, and when we talk about what happened just last year in 2014, we've done even more, built nearly 40 sites throughout the state, upgraded many of the sites, over 300 to LTE service, expanded Ethernet backhaul to over 300 sites, and increased capacity also on 175 sites. And the capacity piece is really a critical part of what we do on a regular basis. If you think about the network as a highway instead of water pipes, as we get more and more people on the highway to relieve congestion, we add more lanes to the highway. And that's essentially what we're doing through the various projects that we have, whether it's Ethernet or adding radios to a site, adding additional spectrum to a site. We can accommodate both faster speeds and more people and more things on the network. Also in 2014, we completed two sort of higher profile projects. We put a distributed antenna system into TCF Stadium. The capacity that we have in TCF Stadium basically is adequate for a city the size of about 50,000 people. And then we're also doing upgrades from a capacity standpoint to that plan in 2015. And then we also put a distributed antenna system in the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And again, that's to help us get penetration into the tunnels and subways and allow people to have their mobile service throughout the facility there. When we look into the future, into 2015 and beyond, we're continuing to invest in the network. A few of the things that we have on the docket for the coming years is HD Voice, or a high-definition voice product that runs over our LTE network. And another big piece that was in the news recently was the results of the AWS-3 auction, which is where we bought additional spectrum to ensure that we'll be able to serve our capacity for our customers into the future throughout the next, you know, 5 or 6 years. So we're looking down the pipe to make sure that we do continue to have adequate coverage there. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned earlier, we're very excited about the opportunity, should we be successful in securing approval by the FCC to acquire DirecTV. That is currently an open docket. We're hopeful that the decision on that will be made sometime early this spring. One of the commitments that we made as part of the transaction and comments that have been filed with the FCC is that we will provide a new rural broadband service to 13 million Americans, rural locations, within 4 years after the close of this transaction. It will be a service known as Fixed Wireless Local Loop. It's a graphic representation of that. I believe that's in your packets as well. This will be a service, and most specifically, as I mentioned, the 13 million, but most specifically for Minnesota, that's going to be able to reach 500,000 rural locations in Minnesota. That will be providing a fixed wireless solution. This is not satellite technology or not kind of your wireless, what you would have on your wireless package. This will be a dedicated service that will be priced similar to what a current broadband package would be from any competitor. It will be at speeds of anywhere from 15 to 20 megabits, certainly well above the state minimum standards. It will provide all the opportunities for Hulu or Netflix or YouTube and any of those type of things with a data package that will meet household demands. And basically, we'll be able to come out with something that looks like, I've used the term larger than a shoebox, but that outdoor antenna on the side there, and you will have wireless broadband directly to the home. Something that we'll be installing, some will come out. So it would give you the full array of the services, DirecTV, AT&T wireless broadband, and then AT&T wireless service through with your phone as well. So we're very excited about that, and that's something that we hope to be successful at this spring.
Thank you. Representative Green?
And then thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at this, one thing that occurred to me is, as a former satellite TV subscriber, what happens in bad weather?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, I too am a DirecTV. I may be the only Cleveland Browns fan in Minnesota that signs up for the NFL Sunday ticket, but that's my penance, if you will. But you know, I've had that for a couple of years, and there are some occasions where with snow and things of that nature, you do have those experiences. But I think in the long haul, for those people that don't have access to cable television or may not even have access to like a digital antenna system, that DirecTV will help solve those. But the broadband part of this is completely separate. If you can get a 4G LTE connection off our existing infrastructure, you will be able to get this wireless broadband service because of the dedicated spectrum that will be part of this service.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify then, you're telling me that the broadband part of this won't be affected by weather conditions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Next we have Representative Mahoney.
Actually, I have two questions, Mr. Chair, so thank you. I think you answered this one. So, because I don't really know enough about broadband and internet and the connections and the speeds, that other than my stepson's phone number. So with what you're talking about here, you'll be able to stream movies and all that goes along with that, and you talked about Hulu and all the other, so that won't be interfered with, correct? I mean, that's what 20 meg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, that is correct. Yeah, this is today as we have it. If you have a wireless plan with a carrier, those are data sensitive, mm-hmm. data constricting, and I've got teenage daughters at home and have to tell them go on Wi-Fi. You don't want to be watching, because you could eat up your family plan. Although I will tell you, that too is becoming more and more competitive between the carriers. This is not going to be impacted by this. This will be a standalone broadband payment plan. We haven't put out the price points or anything. Part of it is because we have to get approval by the FCC to even go forward with the transaction. But it will be something that will be dedicated spectrum. It will be a dedicated price plan so that, you know, what you pay for broadband is what you would pay for a fixed wireless local loop broadband service.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, my second question is, how long before the FCC requires you to rent that all out to your competitors?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, there's a lot going on at the FCC right now that I wouldn't go to Vegas trying to try to figure out the decisions.
I was trying to give you a softball here, but you know.
We don't have a lot of sense of humor right now at the FCC.
Well, you know, you are a Cleveland Browns fan.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to our testifiers today. So you've heard, perhaps you heard earlier, I offered a critique of our current statewide plan that is steered towards wired infrastructure. Can you just, from at a low-level technical perspective, explain why AT&T is investing in wireless versus fixed wire technology for distribution of broadband services?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, what this does in terms, there are 22 states in our footprint where we are what I would call the incumbent phone provider, where we have a wireless solution, we have a broadband solution, and we have a video solution, kind of our version of cable television. This really gives us a 50-state footprint in terms of being able to offer the triple play. So we'll have broadcast television through DirecTV, we have our wireless phone solution, and now we'll have a to-the-home wireless broadband solution through this technology. So I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Chairman, and to the testifiers, so from the infrastructure side, basically, it gives you more flexibility to serve more people at a lower price by going wireless as opposed to putting fiber to every cabin and house in a low-density area. Is that correct?
Mr. Wirtz.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think that would be correct to say one of the reasons to upgrade to an LTE type of technology over the previous technology is that it is a more efficient use of spectrum and a bandwidth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just listening to all this conversation, I actually had somebody talk to me recently about the fact that they have very poor regular landline phone. The issue is that one of them has to connect with, now I'm going to lose a term, for their pacemaker. They have to have their pacemaker checked over a landline. They do it about every 3 months. Is there any technology that will allow them to go away from having to have a landline for that check that they do remotely?
Either Mr. Chairman, Representative Keel, I think we can get you an answer to that. There's a number of that type of question comes up in a number of states where carriers are looking to modernize their regulations and move into kind of getting away from the carrier of last resort, and there are those folks that, as we're transitioning from a landline base to an internet base, where they may, you know, fall into those situations and have that. But I would also say from our product offering, we have a product here, and actually it's a national product called Digital Life. So more and more, and that's all wireless as well, it's home security, home automation. It's moving beyond just, you know, kind of keeping the bad guys away. It's monitoring utilities. We're seeing more and more, where they can actually put sensors on clothes and you can get those feedback, some of the whole smart technology. So we can get you a more specific answer to that, but it, definitely the technology is moving in that direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just they're kind of in a no man's land right now with no broadband. They're having trouble getting it, and I don't know why that is. They're in a pocket not far from me, but and that's what I was. I'd be interested in what can be done about those issues, because every once in a while you find somebody who is, and maybe they're just not accessed to the right facility, right technology.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think all of my colleagues here, there's the right people are here today to try to help solve that situation for you.
Thank you.
Representative Miller for the second time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We actually do get along great, I think. Just a quick question of the $40 million that's proposed, or $30 million, I guess, is proposed, and perhaps up to $40 million of the Minnesota State Broadband Grant. How much does AT&T plan to apply for in that grant?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, we don't apply for public funding. For we prefer to just invest our private capital in our builds and networks, et cetera.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and I'm terrible with names, so I apologize. But
Paul Wirtz.
Thank you. I was terrified you would give me a different answer, but I think I made my point. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very enlightening. Next we have Brent Christensen, former mayor of Medelia, Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to attempt to get technology going here.
And it doesn't work. All right. Well, we'll just work off the handouts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen. I'm President and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. You should have some handouts in front of you that kind of go through the slide deck that that I had prepared. Can you find more? I'm already hooked up. We'll get by with that. As I go through this, I think it'd be a little bit better to kind of tell you a little bit about what the MTA is and what we're not. The MTA are basically an organization of 45 broadband providers who serve rural Minnesota. And our members range from CenturyLink all the way down to one company that has 189 broadband subscribers. So we have the real big guys and the real little guys. MTA members have kind of transitioned from being what you would know as landline telephone companies to being broadband providers. One of the things that we're not is we're not cable companies. A long time ago, the industry kind of collided, and we used to offer telephone service. They offered cable TV. Now they offer everything that we do, voice, video, and broadband. We're also not cellular companies. Kind of disappointed that Representative Garofalo left, because I did want to kind of challenge him a little bit on his philosophy about wireless, because our members, while we don't provide cellular service, we provide the fiber to the towers that make cellular work. The only thing that works, the only thing cellular about cellular is from the tower to the handset. The rest of it rides on the same network, and most of that is provided by my members throughout the state, particularly in the rural areas where they're not able to build out the fiber themselves. We're also not Vonage and Magic Jack. We're not those people that provide a voice service over your internet connection, try to tell you that they're a telephone company, and then provide substandard service. Our members for over 100 years have gotten used to providing five nines reliability and a quality voice product. Now we do the same thing with our video services and our broadband services. So the question is, I was asked to come and talk a little bit about how MTA members deploy broadband. And there are different technologies that we use to deploy broadband. I don't think it's a big secret that in the landline business, everything is going to fiber. We started off with cable wires. Our cable friends use coax. But we're all pushing fiber closer and closer to the end user. And the reason that we're doing that is that the closer we can get fiber to the end user, the faster speeds that we can offer them. So the goal is eventually to have fiber to everybody. And I don't think everything's going to be replaced by wireless at some point. I think there's a play for both. You want higher speeds at home. You want the mobility of cellular. I think there's a place for everybody. There's going to be a pipe to your home, and then you'll still have a cellular connection. It's not one or the other. You know, we talk a little bit, I heard some earlier testifiers talk about going home and telling them on the cellular network, wait till you get home and you can use your Wi-Fi signal. Well, that's a wireless signal that you get from your provider at home. Most likely in a rural area, it's going to be one of my members. It's very expensive to build out fiber, to overhaul your whole network at once. We have a lot of companies that are doing fiber to the node. So they're taking fiber out closer to the customer, but not all the way. And they're using existing copper plant for that less little distance so that they can get the broadband speeds that they need. And then over time, as that copper goes bad, they typically replace that with fiber. So we're going to an all-fiber network. It's just the question is, how are we going to get there? We also have some members that are using fixed wireless to get broadband to those really hard-to-serve and really expensive areas. Some are using licensed spectrum that they've got licensed from the FCC to use. Some are using some unlicensed spectrum to get that broadband out. But it's more of a stopgap measure in many ways to get broadband to somebody who has nothing today. And then as you develop those customers, you're able to build out fiber to them and get that fiber closer and closer to them. I think it's important in this conversation that we differentiate broadband speed with how it's delivered. It doesn't matter how you get your broadband. You get it over fiber, copper, fiber to the node, fixed wireless. You can still get the same level of speed in many cases. Just because you have a fiber to the home doesn't mean that you're getting a gigabit of service. There are a lot of providers that have fiber to the home that are not offering those full speeds. I always tell everybody that in our business, we have to be one step ahead of the customer's need. If we're two steps ahead, we're at the bleeding edge and we can't pay for it, and if we're even with them, we're too late. So we try to get that infrastructure out there and at least stay at least one step ahead of the customer. The next slide that you've got came from the Office of Broadband Development and the old Connect Minnesota report, and it shows the different speed levels. Well, let me back up. I'm missing a slide here. I didn't turn the right page, sorry. The next one is the percentage at stake goal, and Dana talked about this earlier, and this will be the only time that you see me differentiating speed goals by our delivery method and by landline service. And I do that for two reasons. One, I had the privilege of serving on the first broadband task force that led to the recommendations that got adopted into law for the 10 megabit down and the 5 megabit up. And in that task force, we had 26 people and a whole variety of different interests represented there. And we decided that we needed to be technology agnostic for the very reason I just said earlier about the difference between the delivery system and then the speeds that you're getting. The other reason is that the goals of the 10 and 5 goals, they were born out of compromise. All of us on the task force worked together, and we just decided there was no magic number about it. So it's really important to keep those two things in perspective. So this shows that from April 11th to October of 14, the steady growth in broadband speeds available and reaching the state goal for just the landline broadband business. And that's what used to be telephone companies and then the cable providers. And that shows that this has risen from just under 30% to just under 80% as of last October. So this is going up all by itself. Now, it got a little help from the 2009 era grants that were awarded in Minnesota. That kind of pushed the needle a little bit. But this is basically illustrates the investment that private providers have made. And I also will say, before the broadband grant program came out, we had no assistance from the state of Minnesota whatsoever. A lot of the help that we got to do this came from the Federal Universal Service Fund, but there was nothing at the state level before the broadband grant. Now, if you look at the page that I pulled out earlier, that I meant to pull out now, it shows the different speed tiers, and this is across all platforms and what's available to consumers in Minnesota. And you can see that as you move that up and down needle, you can get pretty much any level of coverage you want in the state. So if you go to 10 by 6, which is the state goals and a little bit more on the upload side, you see that 88.9% of the state has access. But if you change that upload speed from 6 megabit and you drop that down to 3 megabit per second, we're at 99.67%, which, so you know, is better penetration than landline telephone service ever was. That was at 98%. So broadband coverage at that speed is bigger. Now, the FCC has recently changed, as in like last week, changed the definition of broadband to 25 down and 3 up. And if you look in this map, they track it at 25 and 1.5. We're still at 87.9. So this kind of gives you an idea. You can take a look at it from whatever angle you want and get an idea. So the next slide, so where does that leave us? Basically, the state of Minnesota has met the download speed goal to 99.67% at the 10 megabit down. We're there. We've met the speed upload goal to 88.9% of Minnesotans. Broadband speeds are increasing every 6 months all by themselves. But there are still Minnesotans without access to landline-based broadband, and that's really what this conversation is about. There are only two ways to move that needle. That's with state and federal assistance or successful private-public partnerships. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Christensen, you talk a little bit about the public-private partnerships, and I've had some conversations over the last month or so with some folks, you know, trying to kind of define what exactly that means, kind of where that line is between what the private utilization and what the public utilization is of broadband, and, you know, from my perspective, trying to figure out where different sources of funding can come from for broadband development. So could you please just elaborate or give me some of your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lean, I'd be happy to. I think there are some really good examples in Minnesota where private-public partnerships have worked, and I think there are some examples where public networks have failed. I think we've got some, you know, the grant program is going to prove out the ones that I think have worked well. The project that's awarded in Big Stone County has worked. Lacaparral County has worked very well. And that's where the counties have used the resources at their disposal to kind of overcome the cost of installation. And in almost every case, the reason that there's not broadband everywhere is because of the cost of installation and overcoming that. And using local resources to plus the grant program to overcome that is the reason that that's going to work. And Mr. Chairman, if I might, Representative Keel had a question earlier about had a consumer that doesn't have coverage everywhere. I would bet you that she is probably in between, you know, at the end of either one of two lines. And that really is the problem that the grant program is designed to solve. And that's where we're going to need some help, because it goes back to the cost of installation. We can't get decent broadband speeds to those people because they're at the end of the line or very close to that. And those are the hardest customers to serve. The closer we can move fiber out to them, the higher speeds and more quality service they're going to get.
Representative Lane, you have any more questions?
Not right now.
Okay. Okay, any other questions for Mr. Christensen? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mike Martin, Executive Director of Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Martin. I'm, as you said, I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. We're a trade group representing cable companies in Minnesota. I'm joined here today by Bill Jensen, who is a regional vice president for MediaCom based in Waseca, Minnesota. I thought what we would do is I'll make a couple of comments, and then I'm going to ask Bill to talk a little bit about MediaCom. Our goal here is to kind of give you an idea of what some of the cable companies around Minnesota have done, and hopefully demonstrate the enormous investment that's been made by the cable industry in providing broadband services. A couple of comments. Cable companies do not receive any subsidy of any kind from the federal government. You know, there's universal service supports and other things, Connect America funds, other things like that. Cable companies have never been eligible to receive those funds. As a rule, cable is a privately funded entity from the private equity markets. Also, I'd like to stress, and we've certainly seen it here today, that all of the services provided by cable companies are in competition with other sectors. We've heard from cellular companies providing voice and broadband services. Telephone companies are providing video services or reselling satellite services. The satellite companies certainly are active. A third of homes across Minnesota use satellite for their video product. So the market is certainly very, very competitive, and that has a huge impact on the level of of investment. So I think at this time, if I could, I'd ask Mr. Jensen to talk about Mediacom and some of the services that they provide.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Bill Jensen. I'm the Regional Vice President for Mediacom here in Minnesota and four other states. I'm based at our regional office in Waseca, Minnesota, and I'm a Lakeville, Minnesota resident. I'm also Mike's boss, so I get to keep an eye on Mike. Some of you may know that Mediacom is a telecommunications company. We're a national company. We're in 22 states. Our biggest footprint for telecom is just south of Minnesota in the state of Iowa. But for the most part, our network was built to serve rural America, focusing on providing advanced broadband, video, and telecommunication services to smaller cities and towns throughout Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, and in 21 other states. Here in Minnesota, to just kind of give you a little graphic representation, here in the metro Minnesota area, we've got the Lake Minnetonka area surrounded, except for the city of Minnetonka, so we're out in Orono and Minnetonka Beach and Mound, et cetera, et cetera. We're all the way up on the Iron Range with Hibbing and Grand Rapids, Eblith, many of those communities. We go down along Interstate 90, Worthington, Laverne, Pipestone, et cetera. And, of course, we're down in southeastern Minnesota as well. A couple of things, and I know we're here today to talk, to hear from the folks at Deed and hear about the successes of the broadband grant program. You're probably aware by now, as the director showed, Dana McKenzie on her presentation, Mediacom is a recipient of a $137,000 broadband grant. It's the first ever for us in Minnesota. We're really excited about it. That grant will allow us to build 8 miles of wired broadband plant serving 122 homes in right outside the city of Hibbing. What's interesting about this grant program, and the folks at Deed deserve a lot of credit, because as an operator in Minnesota, as an applicant, we had a lot of questions. And I can tell you that when we called, they picked up the phone and they answered our question. The whole process was very, very good, at least for Mediacom. And I can tell you that the end result is it will be a good process from our grant perspective in on the outskirts of the city of Hibbing. And although we have 2 years to build out those 8 miles, we're also going to partner with the city of Hibbing. Those 122 homes on the outskirts of Hibbing have no city water or city sewer. And we're going to partner with them, and hopefully in for the bulk of this project, we're only going to have to dig once. That's what I think is what a true private-public partnership is all about. So again, kudos to the folks over at Deed. We did submit in total build-out $2 million worth of projects, hoping to get $1 million in grant funding. But I'll take the $137,000 as a starting point, and we'll apply again, all right? From a national perspective, Mediacom in the past 2 decades has invested over $7 billion, whether it was acquiring telecommunication systems, upgrading those systems, or expanding our broadband network. Right now, with our cable plant, and we heard the terms homes passed, that's where the plant is in front of those homes or businesses. We pass just over 3 million homes or businesses. And while 75% of our 1,500 franchised communities where we need a video franchise to provide service, that being video service, and of course, you've all been here a while, and you understand that as a franchised video operator, we share our revenues with the communities we serve through both franchise fees and public access fees. Of the 1,500 franchise communities we have in 22 states, 75% of them have 2,000 or fewer homes or businesses in those communities. So we truly are a small operator. So speaking of broadband offerings, because today that seems to be the theme, Mediacom right now, generally speaking throughout our entire footprint in the 22 states, we provide our top services download speeds of 150 megabits per second with upload speeds of 20 megabits per second. We also have a business and an enterprise group that can deploy fiber to the business or the home if need be and deliver speeds up to 10 gigabits per second. I think the real question, and we've heard about some from some competing technologies here today, and I'm certainly not going to say which is better or whatever, but there's that old adage, you know, build it and they will come. Sometimes we ask ourselves, if we build it, will they come? When we upgrade and provide fast broadband service, not everybody signs up for that service. And from the Mediacom perspective, when we build out our broadband plant, which includes fiber, it's not fiber to the foam, it's a mix of fiber and coax. Because I think generally speaking, as an industry, the cable industry, and certainly a Mediacom, we just don't believe at this point that the technology needs true fiber to the premise system. It will probably get to that point down the road. The real question is how fast. But I can tell you that in some of our markets, over a mix of fiber and coax with a coaxial cable television drop to the side of the house, we're delivering broadband download speeds in excess of 300 megabits per second. And the only fiber that's involved is out on the highways and byways where we use to transport the signals. I think Brent Christensen from the MTA said it well. At least in Minnesota, a lot of the cellular traffic, not all, but much of it, is transported over telephone company and cable companies' fiber optic networks. We have a lot of fiber in the ground. So what's next for us? I think that from Mediacom's perspective, there are still a lot of areas out there in rural Minnesota that will definitely benefit from the broadband grant program as it, as we worked on this past year. We're going to resubmit additional projects. I can tell you in Hennepin County, we have a city that has approximately 40 miles of roadways that are either unserved or underserved with adequate broadband speeds. So there are opportunities not just in greater Minnesota, but in metro Minneapolis area. So there are pockets everywhere. The last item is, and all of the folks from the broadband community that are here today, whether they're telephone, cable, wireless, cellular, you know, we're really all kind of doing much of the same things. In the past year at Mediacom, we rolled out that home suite of security services where you can deploy cameras in your home, outside of your home, check your thermostat. We had a customer that wanted a camera on their thermostat in their wine room so they could make sure that it didn't get too hot and too cold. But I digress. I would tell you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I've been a cable guy since 1984. And this has been a tremendous industry. I can tell you nowhere in Mediacom's footprint has any state stepped up, like the state of Minnesota, to offer broadband grant funding. And I think it's exceptional. I think as a committee and the state of Minnesota needs to be commended. So far, this has been a great program, and I certainly hope you continue moving forward down that direction. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, those are my comments.
Thank you. Any questions? You can have another one if you really want to. Anyway, seeing no other questions, seeing that we're done with the testifiers, would anybody else in the audience like to make any comments? We got about 10 minutes. Seeing no one, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.